Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
At least since the invention of the wheel, people have fixed, tinkered with, and improved every device they've possessed. It's been a human right. But after several thousand years, suddenly legal clauses are being tucked in purchase agreements saying that today's owners of products must not even peek, much less poke inside, the inner workings of our devices. Makers of anything with a computer chip in it, everything from your car to your toothbrush, have been especially vehement about this, rewriting human nature by outlawing our right to repair. Yes, they assert, you own the thing, but we own the intangible ideas that make it work. So if the product malfunctions, you must return it to us and pay us a premium to repair it. Plus, they prattle, you could hurt yourself trying to do it yourself, so trust us. Bovine excrement, barks Steve Wozniak. Companies inhibit your rights so they can have power, control over everything. Is he some consumer radical? No, Wozniak is the co-founder of Apple, the multi-billion-dollar global Goliath that is the world's biggest producer of consumer electronics. He's appalled that Apple has now become a fierce opponent of self-repair. He says, we wouldn't have had an Apple, except that early innovators like him grew up in a very open technology world. From the start, he points out, openness helped spread innovation and consumer demand. So, why stop the self-repair community, he asks? Two big reasons. Besides letting corporations lock in monopoly profits from the repair industry, it also dissuades customers from bothering with repairs. Just throw the thing away and buy a new one. This is Jim Hightower saying, if you wonder where such massive, deadly levels of pollution by lead, mercury, plastic, etc. come from, look to the gross throwaway ethic of big tech profiteers like Apple.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So evidently, Mark Meadows has a new book, and evidently the new book says that Trump tested positive for coronavirus on September 26th, which is 3 days before the debate in Cleveland. There are those who are going, hey, could he have gotten Joe Biden sick? I thought Joe Biden had a great line today when he was asked about it. He said, I don't think much about the former guy. I think that was a great line. But here's the thing. On the 26th, if he tested positive, there are tons of places that he would have been and he could have exposed others to. And one of the interesting things to me is you had one of his former White House officials, this Alyssa Farah, who told Jake Tapper that she was stunned to learn that Trump had tested positive for the virus the days before the debate. She was shocked. The revelation shocked her. She said, this demonstrates a flagrant lack of regard for public health and the well-being of others. She goes into saying, look, there were pregnant women. There were people over 65. There were a bunch of people there who were at risk, and he could have put them all at risk. And I'm sitting here listening to this going, and this surprises you somehow? This is who he is. And here to share some thoughts on, well, this I've asked our good friend, Dr. Keith Pocheck, to come talk with us. Dr. Keith, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me on again. I appreciate it.
Great so I'm looking here. At this. I'm looking at this Alyssa Farah's comments that she's stunned. She's shocked. It's a reckless disregard for the safety of the pregnant women and the cancer survivors and the people over 65. He could have killed one of her colleagues. Now she seems upset about it. Am I missing something here?
No, I mean, it's obviously not a surprise. I think that it's probably more damning to the White House staff, to Meadows himself, to the medical staff who allowed him to continue to travel. He did a rally, I think, on the same day. That's where he was in the air to go to the Pennsylvania rally when he got the news about having the positive test. But basically at that point, everyone was trying to appease him with what he wanted to hear. So, okay, yeah, we'll do another test. Sure, it's less sensitive, but it's going to give you the result that you want to hear, and then we won't talk about it again. If you'll notice too, in that Guardian article, who kind of like dropped the initial scoop, the debate that happened in Cleveland on the 29th, which was after he had his positive and then subsequent negative crappy test. He arrived late, quote unquote, arrived late and didn't get tested prior to the debate. And they took him at good faith that he did not have COVID. And it makes you, you know, obviously suspicious that
how convenient
that was all intentional and planned, that, you know, he showed up late or, you know, didn't arrive on time on purpose. Because he knew he was carrying COVID at that point.
Now, how convenient. Now, I went back and I looked at the news stories around that debate. And one of them on October 3rd from Cleveland.com was that at least 11 people tested positive for COVID after the debate. They believe got it there and all of that. And I got to tell you, I remember that debate well. I was under the impression that he had already had it. That was what was being floated at the time anyway, which is why they had done, the kind of social distancing that they did. Because I remember there being stories that he did show up and do what he did. So it's kind of ringing a bell for me. But this just kind of confirms what we thought back then, like a lot of these books are doing right now.
Yeah, and it's one of those where you can dive and you almost have to dive a little bit into statistical concepts and test characteristics just a bit to really understand what it all means. But the fact that he had a positive test, the specificity of those tests, even in those generation of tests, was so high that it was absolutely reckless to assume that a subsequent test is negative, because the sensitivity, the likelihood of picking up a positive case, was far lower than the specificity. And so that's where I don't want to drive things too far off the rails and get too far into statistics, but that's really important, because there's a far higher likelihood that a positive test is positive with these types of tests then a negative test is truly negative.
Right.
And you know, it's guaranteed that his medical team knew this. Did his chief of staff know it? And did he know it? I don't know. I mean, I think they probably can play dumb and make a valid excuse that they are actually dumb. And they wanted to, appease him with the result that he wanted to hear. But his medical team and the scientists there that he was working with that no other American had access to could clearly have laid out those concepts, and that, hey, look, it's completely reckless to assume that positive test is a false positive.
Right.
That's where I think, I'm not going to say it's a crime, but that's where like the extraordinarily reckless decisions were made by assuming that positive test was a false positive.
Now, just a couple of days later, he was at Walter Reed Medical Center because he was sick. So, I mean, this all play, the timeline plays right in that, he tested positive and he was sick and he was in there and he got the Regeneron or whatever all that was that you and I at the time didn't have access to. There's no question in my mind that this is accurate.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And the other thing too is that we have to remember that in the interim, between the positive test, subsequent negative rapid antigen test, which is nowhere near as accurate as a PCR, or even the other nucleic acid amplification tests that are commonly used. We won't get too far down to the science, but the rapid antigen test that was used to get him his negative that he wanted to achieve is not terribly sensitive. It's in maybe the 60-70% sensitivity rate for symptomatic patients. So they used that test, and then even prior to the debate, had Gold Star families come visit the White House maskless, and they're giving him hugs, and they're, you know, and that was one of the events that he actually used. He actually used some of those events to say that's probably where I picked it up, where he was actually, you know, at that point, he was actually patient zero.
Yeah. No, I mean, I had someone today goes, well, can you believe how he treated the Gold Star family? I'm going, hello, yes. Do you not
He's
remember Kaiser
before.
Khan?
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, I mean, so it's not, absolutely. It doesn't fall outside any sort of expected behavior for him, but it's pretty damning on the White House medical staff and the chief of staff, because I think that they understood those concepts, and instead they just wanted to appease him with the news that he wanted to hear, which you see obviously in authoritarian countries and regimes over and over and over, and you've seen that throughout history, and that's exactly what happened here.
Yeah, and you go, you know, why is this important? Why are we reliving this? Well, the reality is you got to get to the bottom of where the story goes here. You don't get to flip the narrative and say everything that's happened is Joe Biden's fault, when the reality is you got a guy who never took this seriously.
Absolutely right. You are absolutely right. And then, you know, he marches up when he finally does make it out of the hospital after getting the $3 million, $6 million, whatever cocktail of meds that were, like you said, were unavailable to anyone else at that point. He gets discharged from the hospital, comes up the stairs, and just, you know, defiantly rips his mask off and just says to America, this is nothing. Look at me. I just, you know, and that's part of the reason why we're still fighting these same battles that just doesn't seem like we can't, you know, completely get all the traction we need on masks and vaccines.
No, it's crazy. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Dr. Keith Pocheck, talking a little bit about the former guy and, well, super spreader Mr. President that he was. Also, I want to get into a little bit, Keith, with California is the winner. They're the first case of this Omicron variant that's come through, which I'm told is going to be, you know, spreading across the country. We better be prepared for it. And yet we've got Republicans who just in a couple of days are threatening a government shutdown. Just how horrible would it be for us to shut down our response to COVID and the Delta variant and now this Omicron that's coming through, if I'm saying that right? How deadly could this be?
Boy, that one's still up in the air, and I'm not sure if is it Omicron or Omicron. I always learned Omicron. I don't know. Like that's someone said that. Hey, that's the silver lining of COVID is that we're all relearning the Greek alphabet. and so I don't know which way you exactly, if there is any silver lining, I don't know which way you exactly say that. But from the way that I understand it is it a bit more vaccine evading? It seems like the data suggests that. Is it more serious, deadly, more likely to cause hospitalizations and deaths? It doesn't seem so far in the countries where they've seen a lot of activity there. So I don't know. I mean, I guess that's like the good news, bad news, or maybe I'm trying to be too optimistic about it. And then, you know, the question obviously becomes, what's our, you know, at what point do we reach herd immunity? I mean, you know, we've had obviously so many millions of Americans who've been affected with COVID. Infected with COVID, and so many who've been vaccinated. Do we get to that point, or does this thing just continue to evolve and become, seasonal where we do need to have boosters and becomes more along the lines of influenza. And, you know, we're living through history here. And, you know, and that's why it's so important, I think, right now to just sort of trust the scientists and the people who know and the people who've studied this and have dedicated their lives to this instead of, you know, talking heads, you know, in the media. I mean, you can't, there's no substitute for that level of knowledge and experience. And we've put, you know, we've put folks on equal footing who have, you know, there's no basis to put them on equal footing.
Right. Are you saying we shouldn't be listening to, oh, I don't know, a televangelist like this, this Marcus Lamb? Maybe we shouldn't be listening to Marcus?
Maybe not. And, you know, to me, Rick, you know, occasionally you see some, I don't want to say it's celebratory, but it's just like, hey, we told you so. You know, when you see these stories over and over of these anti-vaxxers who are public about it and they wind up getting sick or they die, or there's no celebration in my mind when that occurs anymore, because not only is it, hey, this is somebody we just for some whatever reason we couldn't reach, and then also I just feel for the healthcare workers who needlessly had to toil trying to keep this person alive, and you know just how many hours they spent when they're already understaffed, and how many gallons of sweat they poured out wearing their gowns and you know to fight for this person's life, who probably in all likelihood, if he had followed recommendations and gotten vaccinated, would have never been in the hospital in the first place. And that's where the real tragedy is. Obviously, that's I'm sitting in the seat of someone who's worked in healthcare for a couple decades.
Yeah, I know. I look at this and look, I don't celebrate someone's passing, but I also, I'm not mourning this guy. I mean, at the end of the day, he made a choice. We are in a moment right now where we know that the people who are being hospitalized at overwhelming rates and the people who are dying are the unvaccinated. You've made that choice. I've gotten to the point where I don't think the mandate is going to help or happen. I've come to the point, and I've been here for a very long time, capitalism is going to decide this. If you don't get vaccinated, your insurance rates are going to skyrocket. You're going to have negative outcomes. Your employers are going to have problems. I see this as capitalism decide because, well, our government has been ineffective to this point.
I agree with you. And I think, you know, I mean, it's, you know, if you look at our vaccination rates, sure, you know, they lag behind for a quote unquote developed country, but still pretty good. What are we in the 70% range or so? And that's respectable. But I think what heartens me a bit, you look at a place like New York City, and they've introduced so much friction into the system for unvaccinated people that it's just made it really hard, I think, to live your life there as someone who's unvaccinated. You know, I mean, don't get in this cab if you're not vaccinated. Don't get on the subway if you're not vaccinated. Don't come in this restaurant if you're not vaccinated. You know, I mean, a bunch of employers have the vaccine mandate. And I think that's what changes sort of the recalcitrant folks right there. We're going to make it incredibly inconvenient for you. So eventually you're going to say, you know what, I'm tired of spending all this time and money to get around this for something that, you know, I've dug my heel in over, and I'm just going to go ahead and follow suit.
Yeah, and this is where I've been saying, you know, capitalism will decide, and it'll figure it out, and we're eventually going to get there. But Dr. Keith, I appreciate you taking some time for us, sharing your knowledge. Always great talking with you, buddy.
Thank you, Rick. Appreciate you having me.
Good stuff. Our good friend, Dr. Keith Pocheck. Going to take a quick break right here. Back with your thoughts. 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Back after this.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1912. That was the day the Anaconda Copper Company instituted its rustling card system at its mines in Butte, Montana. The company used the rustling cards in two ways. First, as a work permit, and then as a way to keep track of miners. A miner looking for work would first have to apply for a card. Miners had to present information about citizenship status, English literacy skills, work history, and 2 years of employer references. Once the card was approved, the miners would then be allowed to apply for work. The Butte Miners Union charged that it was the company's way of blacklisting those who had quit, been fired, or known as union militants. By 1917, the Metal Mine Workers Union and the IWW added that the company was looking to nip agitation in the bud. They alleged employers were holding onto cards or denying them altogether for no reason. According to historian Paul Brissenden, both unions maintained the company was looking to, quote, punish those who were at one time active in the socialist administration of Butte Mayor Lewis J. Duncan, to prevent the Socialist Party from again securing a foothold in Butte, to strengthen the hands of the more conservative unions, and to curb the industrial unionism of the IWW and Metal Mine Workers Union. The company asserted its right to keep out its enemies out of the mines, alleging they presented a danger to mine safety. But the unions shot back, stating the blacklist meant the hiring of untrained, inexperienced workers who presented the real danger. Brissenden notes that many union radicals continued to work in the mines despite the card system.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
The Strategic Petroleum Reserve will be replenished.
That story and a boatload of other news from while we were out.
That boatload from the GNR Strategic Reserve. And more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
It's also not the best look right after you come back from a climate conference. We must end our addiction to fossil fuels. What's that? Gas is $3.50 a gallon. Let the rivers be choked with crude oil and the carcasses of pelicans.
This is your Green News Report.
Burn!
Hey, Desi Doyen, the Green News Report, we're back.
I know.
And as is the tradition, when we're gone for a week, we come back with a boatload of stories that you catch us up in somehow or another in just 6 minutes. Good luck.
Okay. Well, first, the bad news. More fossil fuel deaths, this time in Russia. Top managers at a coal mine in Siberia have been arrested after a buildup of methane gas in a ventilation shaft ignited last week, killing at least 52 people. Mm. It's the worst mining disaster in Russia in over a decade, according to officials.
That we know of.
In central Iran. Violent crackdowns on farmers protesting water shortages. The protests have been taking place over the past month in the beds of dried-up rivers. The farmers allege mismanagement and misallocation of scarce water resources. The Iran Meteorological Organization says that 97% of Iran now faces water scarcity issues amid an unprecedented drought exacerbated by man-made climate change. In Brazil, the Amazon rainforest saw record deforestation, the most since 2006, according to a new report. Critics accused President Jair Bolsonaro's administration of delaying the release of that report until after the recently concluded UN climate summit in Glasgow.
Of course he did.
Here in the U.S., the storm-weary Pacific Northwest is getting hit this week with yet another freight train of consecutive atmospheric rivers, bringing relentless heavy rain, severe floods, and major infrastructure damage. Mm. The National Weather Service on Monday confirmed that Seattle just broke its record for the wettest fall in recorded history.
Wow. And in Seattle, that is saying something.
In California, a preliminary report finds that climate-fueled wildfires have destroyed about 20% of all giant sequoias in just the past 2 years.
Horrible.
In the nation's capital, after OPEC producers resisted calls to increase production, President Biden ordered the release of 50 million gallons of oil from the nation's Strategic Petroleum Reserve to help ease spiking gas prices that are fueling inflation.
Did it work?
No. Analysts say the very gradual release from the reserve will have, at best, minimal effect on retail gas prices. State Department Energy Advisor Amos Hochstein told CNBC on Monday that the administration will release more from the reserve if needed.
This is a tool that was available to us and will be available again. Remember, this Strategic Petroleum Reserve will be replenished. And therefore, we have more flexibility to be able to do this again if the need arises.
Oh, I'm sure it won't.
In a new report, the Biden Interior Department recommended overhauling the nation's oil and gas leasing program on the public's lands, saying, quote, it fails to provide a fair return to taxpayers even before factoring in the resulted climate-related costs that must be borne by taxpayers.
So the oil companies and coal companies will be paying the U.S. more to take our natural resources?
Yes, the report recommends hiking royalty rates that have not been raised in more than 100 years.
Oh, man.
Taxpayers for Common Sense estimated that that has cost taxpayers an estimated $13 billion in lost revenue just since 2010.
But let's not pick winners and losers, right?
The report calls for increasing bond payments. That's money that drillers must set aside to cover costs of cleanup and land restoration. It also recommends limiting the lands and waters available for drilling. Critics note the report did not address the leasing program's contribution to climate change and that it stopped short of recommending an end to the oil and gas leasing program on public lands.
Well, Biden has tried to stop oil and gas leasing on public lands for new leases, but he has approved more drilling permits than even George W. Bush.
Yep. But some good news.
Good.
The Interior Department also approved the second large offshore wind farm for the U.S. off the coast of Rhode Island. In Germany, the new incoming government committed to phase out coal entirely by 2030, 8 years earlier than previously planned.
Nice.
Plus a target of 80% renewable electricity by 2030 and mandatory rooftop solar on all new commercial buildings.
Nice and nicer.
Portugal announced that it is now entirely coal-free 9 years earlier than its deadline.
Wow.
Nearly 70% of Portugal's electricity is now generated from renewable energy sources.
Sweet.
And finally, Scotland announced that renewable energy met 97% of its electricity demand in 2020.
Well done, Desi Doyen, for much more on all of those stories. And yes, even more that we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
866-416-RICK. That's 866-416-7425. You got a thought, question, comment, something on your mind. National Labor Relations Board General Counsel Jennifer Abruzzo, she tweeted out a couple of things that they caught my attention, things that I think are really, really going to be helpful. She tweeted out the National Labor Relations Act says nothing, says that nothing in it should be construed to interfere with or impede or diminish in any way the right to strike. But for many years, she writes, the NLRB's case law has allowed the permanent replacement doctrine to do just that. And she included the language from the law stating, quote, nothing in this act except as specifically provided for herein shall be construed so as either to interfere with or impede or diminish in any way the right to strike or to affect the limitations or qualifications on that right. She is now saying, in the recent memo that the general counsel put out, she said she's going to examine whether a change is necessary in the permanent replacement doctrine to fulfill the mission of the act. This is the important part. Thus, if a charge is filed involving this issue, she'll consider whether it's appropriate to ask the NLRB to reconsider the law. Now, you look at what's going on right now. You have nurses who have been on strike for months. On strike for months in Worcester, Massachusetts at St. Vincent's Hospital. Who the only thing holding them back from going back to work is the hospital saying, we'll put your people back to work. We're going to let the scabs go, and we're gonna put everybody back to work. We're not going to permanently replace people. Right now, you've got Kellogg's. Kellogg's, who the negotiations broke down. They said, "Well, we're gonna permanently replace your members." Now, look, the BCTGM members have been on strike for about 8 weeks now. This kind of messaging coming out of the general counsel, I think, is really important. the fact that she's saying, look, bring this to bring this to us and we will look at it again. Bring this to us and we will do something about it. So to me, this is telling those nurses, hey, bring this to me. We're going to actually do something about it. I think this is a good thing. Let's go to the phone lines. We've got Leo on line one. Leo, how you doing tonight? Leo, you there?
Oh, hi. Yeah, this is Leo. Yeah, how you doing? I'm sorry. I thought you were asking for Bill.
No, no, Leo. That's you, man.
I have a little something which will make no sense to you. I'm a little bit drunk, so I apologize for everyone. But, this COVID thing, I'm sorry to say, is going to be a never-ending disaster. And I'll tell you why I think it is.
Please do.
In Vermont today, they said that 78% of the people in Vermont are vaccinated, and the hospitals are being filled up with people that have COVID. And I'm wondering if we as a country are going to put up with having us and our children get vaccinated every effing 6 months. It is ridiculous. It is unpatriotic. And
I'm not getting the unpatriotic part, but okay. Here's the thing, and I'm looking at the Vermont story of the folks who are filling up their hospitals, and like here in Pennsylvania where I'm at, the people who overwhelmingly who are in the hospital sick are the unvaccinated. So it's the unvaccinated who are causing this to go longer than it has to.
And I disagree.
Okay, well, the facts and the numbers don't lie. It is what it is, Leo.
It's to get COVID and get over this garbage. Get the virus. Get through it.
Okay.
It's a cold. And everybody's going to be okay with it. Some of us will die.
All right.
You know what? Old people are supposed to die. I'm sorry. 85-year-old people, 95-year-old people are going to die.
All right. So you get it, you die, we'll be okay with that. Leo, I appreciate the call, man. We're not delving down that hole. And look, there are some people who believe this. There's some politicians who believe it. And I say, look, and this is where I've been. You don't want to get vaccinated at this point? Don't. What I know... Here's what I know. The people who are struggling are the people who aren't vaccinated. That's a way to thin the herd. And maybe Leo's right. Those are the folks who are going to go. But Leo, appreciate the call, man. And good for you tying one on a Wednesday night. Good stuff. And I go back to this. Capitalism is going to decide. I have a relative who the reality is, got a bill from the insurance company, an additional $1,500 for his insurance because he's not vaccinated. They're going, okay, we know if you get it, you're probably going to go to the hospital. You're going to cost us a boatload of money. We know the unvaccinated are costing us, the insurance company, a boatload of cash. It is, we're going to have to pass it on. So if you don't have the vaccine, you don't have it, we're going to charge you a little bit more. That's where we're going. Because clearly, telling people it's in your best interest, clearly telling people that this is how we move forward, that ain't working. That's not how, because you're always going to have people going, oh, it's just all stupid. Like somehow they've become epidemiologists and virologists now. And yet here again, I just talked to a doctor who spent his entire career learning about this stuff and lived through the whole pandemic, watching people die. But that's where we are. But Leo, I appreciate the call. Let's go to line three. We got Alice on three. Alice, how are we doing?
Pretty good, Rick. How are you?
I can't complain. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to say, in regards to your previous caller, that I live in a wee little hamlet down in southwestern Pennsylvania, and the prevailing opinion seems to be the same as his, that no one should get vaccinated. And everyone now all over town is coming down with COVID. The vaccination rate here is a big 33%.
Wow.
And people are dropping dead right and left, and they're not old people either. They're young people. So, quite frankly, I'm willing to get another jab. I've had three, so I think the patriotic thing to do is, of course, to get your jab.
Well, I'm not going to go with patriotic. The decent thing to do is, if you're not going to, don't make other people sick. Stay away from them. This is the weird thing that some people think they have the right to make others sick, which is bizarre to me.
It is very bizarre, and it's certainly not Christian, that which they seem to spout every time they turn around, that, it's the mark of the devil or something equally amusing, which I'm not quite sure where they got that from, but, I don't understand it either.
You know what's also interesting is, in talking with healthcare professionals who have lived through this, the people who are unvaccinated, when they get it and before they get intubated, they're asking for the vaccine, which is really just eventually come around.
If they survive, but that's a little bit like shutting the barn door, as they say, after the horses have gotten out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, I just wanted to call in and
Thank you, Alice.
Hi. Talk to you all the time there on Twitter.
Yep.
Carol Fillion, who what my AKA
is. I got you.
So you have a good one now.
Thank you so much. No, look, at the end of the day here, I mean, the reality is I've come to the place where, we're not going to mandate people to get vaccinated. You're going to have to want to do it. You're going to have to want to protect yourself. And this, it's incredible to me, but I know so many people are going, oh, you're not going to make me do it. Well, what we see in these hospitals is, people are struggling. People are going to not make it. And maybe it's going to be you and like this televangelist. Who just passed, 64 years old. I'm sure he thought, hey, I'll get it and I'll make it through. It won't be a big deal. I'm sure he thought the same thing. Marcus Lamb was his name. And he was one of the ones out there saying, no, don't do it. No, it's the mark of the beast. And my favorite one are these people who get the vaccine because you got to continue to go over and then try to figure out how to de-vax themselves. That's the weird part. And I go through, they take baths in hot water. They do bloodletting. The bleach stuff. I mean, I'm still amazed at the level of some stupidity. I thought some of those kid challenges, like the cinnamon challenge or the boiling hot water challenge was bad. This, okay, I'm going to get the vaccine. And then just start slicing, cuts in my arm to hopefully it comes out. Yeah, listen to the experts. I think Dr. Keith Pocheck was right. Listen to the scientists, the people who've spent their lives doing this. That's my thought. And if we want to get through this, this is how we do it. But as I said at the beginning, and the reality is, I have no tears for people who didn't get vaccinated and they find their way out the door. Good luck, better luck on the other side. I hope there's someone there to meet you. But at this point, if we want to get past this, if we want to make sure that there is a future for our kids, maybe help protect ourselves. Now, like you said, there's only going to be a couple percent who are going to die. Do you want that to be you? And when we do, again, eventually overflow our healthcare system, which has happened and probably is going to happen again. The person having a heart attack, the person having cancer, the person having all of the other ailments. Are they going to have more negative outcomes? See, for me, it's always been about the healthcare system. Once you load the place up with people having COVID, you can't deal with the other stuff. I just wish we find a little bit of common sense on this. But thanks for the calls, guys. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, our good friend Bob Ney, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day. Back after this.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1966. That was the day that the registered nurses of the Youngstown General Duty Nurses Association walked out of their jobs. Nursing could be a grueling profession,
with long hours of physical labor for low pay. In Youngstown, the nurses were frustrated because there were inconsistencies in pay. Some recently hired nurses made more than those who had been working for years. Part-time nurses did not receive the same wage increases as full-time employees. They also did not feel that they had enough say in delivering quality care for their patients. When they asked to meet with the hospital's executive director to discuss their concerns, the nurses were rebuffed. They then contacted the Ohio Nurses Association Union and asked for help. Youngstown was a steel town, a union town, and the nurses were ready to join in the local labor movement. At first, the Youngstown Hospital Association refused to bargain with the union. But when the nurses threatened to walk out, negotiations began. After 2 months of talking at the bargaining table, major issues remained unsettled, including pay and union recognition. Fed up, the nurses called for a mass resignation. 305 of the 433 nurses turned in their resignations. Two-thirds of them were part-time nurses. They formed informational picket lines outside the hospitals. A federal mediator was brought in to settle the dispute. In the end, the nurses won significant gains. They received a more than 25% raise over 2 years. A grievance procedure was established for the first time, but most importantly, the union gained recognition and the right to bargain for better wages, hours, and conditions for the nurses and their patients. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So get ready for it. Tomorrow morning, I'm expecting the billionaire owners of baseball teams across the country to lock out their workers. Now, understand, it is not a strike. The players are not going on strike. There's not an impasse. It's not a work stoppage. It's a lockout. These are the billionaire owners of these baseball teams saying, no, we're not going to negotiate. We're done. You're to the curb. They're going to exert their power. This is Major League Baseball. It's on them solely. It is not on the players at all. Remember that tomorrow when you see the reports. Where they talk about, oh, there's a work stoppage, or oh, there's an impasse. No, it's a lockout. The players union, they want to sit and negotiate. The owners, no, they want to impose. And as we've found out, the share of revenue going to the players has been going down, and the owners want even more. And this, you know, at some point, you got to stand up to it. So remember that come tomorrow. It is what it is. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day, our good friend, former Ohio Congressman and political analyst, Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick.
So, baseball lockout coming. Big fun there, huh?
Well, I can tell you the last time we had people calling our office when I was in Congress saying, don't get involved, and other people saying, get involved. Went to the White House. I can remember I was standing with next to Mary Bono. She wasn't congressperson at the time. Sonny was still alive. And we were waiting for President Clinton to come downstairs. Hillary came down, and we were waiting and waiting and waiting. And somebody said, he's upstairs sitting with, I don't know if Bowie Kuhn was the commissioner, I forget. He's upstairs negotiating the strike to end. And he came down. I think he did it, you know. And I was like, okay. You know, maybe Congress doesn't have a role, but maybe the president did. So I do remember when Clinton did something.
Yeah, it was 1994 that happened. Okay. You know, I have a listener who said, no, it wasn't Bill Clinton. It was Michael Jordan, because that was, I guess, the year Michael Jordan went back to basketball. Am I getting that right?
It was after 1994 because I was elected in 1994, started serving in 1995. So it was 1995 when Clinton got involved with the baseball strike or pending strike or something, one of them.
Yeah, I remember the 94 strike. Maybe there was another one.
One or a pending one. It was baseball for sure, but we were downstairs waiting, and Hillary came down saying there's a good reason that he's late. Yeah. And it involved Rick, it could have been football, honestly. I don't know. It was one of those.
It was
one of those.
It was. But the important part tomorrow.
They'll have a hearing on this, and they'll have an investigation.
Yep.
And they'll probably mess up collective bargaining for the players.
Oh, don't even start.
You know, but this is about a collective bargaining agreement, of course, and it is clearly a lockout. You know, and then of course the owner said they're forced into a work stoppage by the players because there's no renegotiated issue of having a collective bargaining agreement. And so they're going to do that in the form of a lockout. So they're going to have the "woe is me, we're forced into this one" deal.
Yeah, we did it, but we were forced into it. Yeah. No, you could have sat down and negotiated, and they're not. You stay at the table and you get things done. And to me, this is where I think we have to look at our labor law in this country, and find a mechanism to where this doesn't. You don't get to have these kind of scenarios.
Well, right, because you know the you know, a strike would be on the player's side, and the lockout is the management side. And these are team owners, and they initiate this stoppage, the team owners. So it's not a refusal to work on behalf as a result of the players, but it's a lockout, and that is a refusal to permit work to be done.
Yep.
That's what a lockout, as you know. I'm just clarifying what I understand of it. You know better than I do, but that's what it is. They're not permitting work to be done by the lockout.
Yeah.
And that means that I think their free agency whole process is frozen on the market and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. The players can't use any of the team facilities, I don't think, during the lockout.
Nope, none of that stuff. And, you know, we'll see where this goes. Now, the season's, you know, not for a while yet.
Right,
they've got time. Maybe they'll come to some resolution. But I just want to make sure that when you wake up, you realize it's a lockout. These are the billionaire owners making this decision. I also wanted to get your thoughts on the revelations that Trump tested positive before the debate with Joe Biden in Cleveland and in your state there, and they knew about it.
You know, this is coming from former chief of staff. And I guess, you know, if it was coming from, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a name who would write a book that you would say, his previous attorney, Cohen.
Right.
You know, who I had no use for Cohen as much as anybody else, but.
Or your buddy with the mustache.
Which one's that?
John Bolton.
Buddy threw me off. John Bolton. Right. Yeah. Well, no, if it came from Bolton, I don't like him. I might halfway believe it, you know. You never know. Of course, Bolton would say that, you know, because he tested positive, he couldn't start another war, you know. But you know, this was the last chief of staff of the president, Mark Meadows. And because it was the chief of staff and Meadows knows the political system, you know, I've got to say that there's most likely some truth to this thing.
No, I think there is, because if you look at the timeline, you know, he was there on the 26th. The debate was on the 29th.
Right.
You got the stories in the Cleveland News of 11 people testing positive out of that. So you did, you know, someone did introduce it there. And then that Friday, he's at Walter Reed, you know, getting Regeneron and all that other stuff. And then all of the craziness of driving around in the limo and all of that comes out of it. The timeline seems to fit.
Right, because Trump announced he had COVID on October the 2nd, and the White House said, and let me make this point. The White House said he announced the result within an hour of receiving it. Now, that could be true, but he tested positive before, then he got another test and said, oh, within an hour of receiving this test, hey, I have COVID, when he already had COVID before.
Right.
He still tested positive for it.
Yeah, again, it's not surprising to me. And you had one of his, you know, top officials, this Alyssa, what was her name again? Alyssa Farah, who's saying, oh my gosh, I'm surprised, I'm shocked. You know, he put people at risk who were, you know, possibly pregnant and all this other stuff. And I'm going, yeah, how are you surprised by this?
Well, and again, on this case, you know, if it was Bolton, you know, and he had an axe to grind because he was fired, et cetera, you know, they always say that. Yeah, well, they don't like me. They have an axe to grind. But in this case, it's the, you know, the last chief of staff, which there didn't seem to be any, you know, great vendetta there by Meadows.
Yeah. This will sell some books because some people are going to want to read it, I guess. Mm-hmm. So there you go. Wanted to get your thoughts on this whole Lauren Boebert, Ilhan Omar story. Evidently, Nancy Pelosi says Democrats can't allow that indecent comment to stand. They're going to do something about it. What can they do? What should they do, do you think?
Well, I think on this one, I think both sides are playing with fire, and I'll tell you why. As much as Gosar, going back to the anime, as much as it was childish, distasteful, wrong in every possible manner, I'm not sure that the House wants to start precedents of saying, you know, you did that and we're throwing you off the committees, number one. Number two, on a political note, and I know you've said this and I agree with you, let the Republicans deal with the Republicans. Let the Democrats deal with the Democrats, unless there's some type of, you know, absolute criminal offense.
Yep.
Then the Ethics Committee deals with it. I think Gosar should go to the Ethics Committee. I think Boebert should. They can file an ethics charge and see what happens out of it. But I think that the House just unilaterally making this is going to start to play with fire, because I think the Republicans will come back. They'll watch for one mistake somebody on the Democrat side makes, and then they're going to demand them to be thrown off the committee. Then all of this becomes the food fight in the stories when there's a thousand other fish to fry. So I'm not saying that the people go unnoticed or unpunished, but it's the method of how you deal with it.
Yeah, no,
and that's why they have an ethics committee. And I think the speaker really needs to be careful because, yes, you know, Boebert, you know, did something wrong, and Boebert's going to say, well, I called to apologize, but she should apologize. Now they're raising the issue of what she said about Jewish people, and nothing really, quote, was done to her for that. Why wasn't something done to her for that? That's what they're going to say. And then this becomes a major distraction when there's an ethics committee process, I think, to deal with these things.
No, I'm right there with you. Yeah. But, you know, here's the thing. I mean, nothing that Boebert said is a surprise. And the fact that I believe all of this is made up in her head is equally not surprising.
Correct.
I mean, it's all about, and this is my problem with our political structure right now, where you've got someone like her in Congress. You've got someone like Marjorie Taylor Greene in Congress, who is really a complete idiot, who just says the most incendiary things to get attention, and we give it to them.
Right. Well, and I think this, again, making this decision as the speaker versus letting the Ethics Committee do it is going to, I think, in the long run, cause some problems. Yeah. And, you know, there's processes. Of course, you know, in the good old days, you know, one member went after another, and then other members retaliated back at him, and, you know, they went back and forth, and that it didn't go to the leadership realms. But also, I think that the Democrats, in doing this, take a lot of the Republicans' problems off of their hands.
Yeah, it's right where I'm at. I mean, let them own her. They absolutely
Correct.
Need it. Last bit I wanted to get from you. Supreme Court today heard the Mississippi case. Any thoughts on where the court might lead on Roe?
Well, I mean, it's not looking good. People are, you know, assuming that today it's going to be the worst. They have, I think, around till June to actually make the case, which will be right in the middle of everything. On a political basis, this may bring some of the women back to the Democrat side that the Democrats have lost. It depends what the justices do. Of course, you know, the Roe versus Wade prevented states from prohibiting abortion before the point of fetal viability. Typically, that was estimated between 22 and 24 weeks. So this one would go to 15 weeks with Mississippi. Now, I will say this, and that's why I can't really judge the impact yet. It'll be 15 weeks if this holds, and 90% of the abortions, as what I read today, are at 13 weeks. So, yes, it would prevent, but 90% are at 13 weeks, so 90% statistically won't be affected. Now, will the 90% of the women that you know, do get abortions, will they stand up and be disturbed for people who go beyond the 13 weeks, you know, 15 weeks in this case?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, it definitely could have a huge impact of reigniting people on this issue.
No, I'm expecting an interesting summer next summer. I expect the decision to come out on the last day as the justices are heading out of town. And the mess being left behind for us to fight over. But it's going to be an interesting
time.
Now,
ironically, the Republicans will try to steer it to three other issues. You know, economy and immigration.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to try to steer it.
As they're doing right now as we speak. But, Bob, I appreciate the time. As always, great stuff, my friend.
Thank you, Rick.
No, he's right. I mean, this is, you know, they're not going to spike the football too loudly, I don't think. They're going to continue to focus on going after, trashing our economy and making things worse in that vein. Because, look, you know, whether you voted for Joe Biden or not, the guy's done the job. The guy has showed up. He's done the job. He's gotten a massive infrastructure bill pushed through. He got a massive rescue plan pushed through that helped families make it through the pandemic. There's a lot of good stuff here. And this Build Back Better plan is something that the family values Republicans should absolutely be behind, because it does help families, helps with child care, helps with early childhood education, helps put a little food on the table so kids don't go hungry, helps with families get access to some family leave if in the event that they need it. There's a lot of stuff in here really popular with working class folks, which is why, sadly, we're probably not going to see it happen. Because the Republicans will do everything they can to block it, even if it means shutting down the government here in a couple of days. December 3rd, get ready for it. I'm sure that they're preparing and trying to, or maybe they'll push it off till December 24th. So it can be our Christmas present. We can wake up Christmas morning to a government shutdown, because that's what they do. It's just, well, we got a lot of organizing to do around this. And a lot of things to pick up on. Finally, wanted to get to the fact that you remember the whole Republican argument, the whole Mike Lindell, the whole Sidney Powell, all of the 2020 was stolen, and you know people are voting multiple times. Well, it turns out, someone did vote multiple times. Evidently, 72-year-old Joan Halstead, who has been arrested and booked in Sumter County, Florida, in jail there. Because evidently she, according to what she's being charged with, voted a number of times. She's been released on bond, $2,000. But evidently in Florida, casting more than one ballot is a third-degree felony, punishable up to 5 years in prison. She, a Trump supporter, according to her Facebook page, according to the reports. I'm interested to see how this goes out. Now, again, you know where I'm at in Pennsylvania, there were a couple of people who, a couple of Republican voters who did vote for others. They voted a couple of times. Well, you know, someone passed away. Well, the kid didn't vote the right way. We're going to go after that. Evidently people do vote more than once. And they seem to be Republicans. How weird. How weird. The people who are pointing their finger going, "You're doing this," are the ones actually doing it. And it reminds me of something my mother always said. When you point your finger at someone, you got three pointing back at you. This is it. This is the GOP. And look, I don't want it to be that way. I want everybody to have access to be able to vote once, be able to get to cast your ballot, have a say in this wonderful experience of self-governance. Instead of having gerrymandered districts like we're seeing states all across this country, barriers between people and their ability to access the ballot box. We need real reform of our voting systems. And that's something Democrats have to do. And they need to do it soon. So there's a lot of work to do here. There's a lot of things that need to be done. There are a lot of opportunities. There are a lot of things that could help us move forward. They just have to be the ones who are going to step forward and get it done. It is that simple. If you've missed any of today's program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast, The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you go. And as always, you can email me at Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Remember, podcast, download the podcast, share, let your friends know, all of that stuff important to do. Again, I want to welcome our new affiliates in Chicago, WCPT, 820 AM, and of course, in Minneapolis, AM 950, KNTF. Thanks for coming along. Back here every weeknight, 9 to 11 Eastern, 8 to 10 Central. And again, if you missed any of it, therickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get. The rest of the week, we've got a lot in store. I want to get to some stuff on the statements of the general counsel from the NLRB. We're going to get some folks to talk about why it's important to do something about the permanent strike replacement doctrine. We're going to get some folks to talk about the abortion hearing here today and where that could lead and the organizing that we're going to need to do around it. This is a big issue, and it's a big issue for men as well. But again, thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
The new Super Beats Heart Chews Advanced is now supercharged with CoQ10. Support your healthy CoQ10 levels and blood pressure with two chews a day. Visit RadioBeats, BEETS.com, and save 15% with promo code DEAL.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.